Welcome to the 3 o'clock session entitled Method or Madness, the Impact of Education on the Willingness to Think. I think you'll all agree that get high points for the title alone, and we have every reason to believe the presentation will be as engaging. Our speaker is Rabbi Dr. Pinchas Haiman, who received rabbinical ordination and doctorate from Yeshiva University. He lectured in the Department of Talmud at Bar Ilan, serving as the university's Dean of Students and as director of the Joseph H. Lookstein Center for Jewish Education in the Diaspora. I'm not going to tell you what he does, because I think he's going to tell us what he does, but I can say that I got a sneak preview by visiting the website Bonayacha just last week, and can already say that I'm a student of Rabbi Haiman, having sampled some of the very interesting materials that are on the website, but they are, I think, just to whet the appetite. And now for some of the full course, we can turn the presentation over to Dr. Haiman. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to share with you a story, something that happened to me a month and a half ago to introduce our topic. A month and a half ago, we had the pleasure of marrying off one of our children, a son, and he married the sister of his sister-in-law, that is, the sister of our older son's wife, two brothers to two sisters. And we were preparing for the wedding on the day of the wedding, about an hour or two before the reception was to begin, and my other grandchildren were around, and I have a three-year-old grandson named Amitsur. So I was speaking with Amitsur before the wedding, and he was all dressed up, and I was all dressed up, and I said to him, Amitsur, why is everybody getting all dressed up? Why are we all so happy? So he said, Shalom and Orit are getting married. Mitchatnim. So I said to him, Amitsur, there's something I don't understand. Shalom is your uncle, and Orit is your aunt. Your uncle is marrying your aunt? So Amitsur kind of looked at me for about 30 seconds and walked away. I expect that kind of a reaction from a three-year-old. But when I speak to graduates of high school yeshivot, and I say to them that when we look at a source, at a textual source of Chazal, we have to know how to think about it. For instance, when Chazal said that after the conquest of the world, that Alexander the Great got up on an eagle and flew into the sky and looked back and saw that the earth was round, naturally, that doesn't mean that he rode to the sky literally on an eagle. And I get the response, a stare, and the response, why not? I know we're in trouble. And therefore, I called the lecture Method or Madness, the Impact of Education on the Willingness to Think. Not on the ability to think, because children all have the ability to think. The question is, are they willing to think? And to what extent are our educational institutions training them to be willing to think? Now, willingness to think is a function of openness. And I feel an obligation to say, after what I heard in the previous session, that there are a lot of stereotypes floating around the community. Modern Orthodox Jews have a tendency to want to make us believe that in the Haredi sector there's an unwillingness to think. Haredi Jews want us to believe that modern Orthodox Jews have an unwillingness to think. Everyone wants to make sure that it's the other that doesn't have a willingness to think. The truth is, everyone may or may not have a willingness to think. It's an individual issue, not an issue of ideological orientation. But the role I expect of an educational institution, and as the father of six and the grandfather of seven, and having sent my children to a wide range of educational institutions, I expect from an educational institution to train my children to be willing and open to think about anything. Because the minute we start closing the mind, sectors of the mind, and saying about this we will not think, about this we will not think, this we will not consider, then the learning process descends to a downloading of information rather than to a real learning process. And what I'd like to share with you today are some sources from Chazal and from the Rishonim about the importance of thinking but when we learn. Because Talmud Torah means thinking. There is no concept that learning Torah merely is the absorption of data, that when you open up a pasuk or a mishnah or a gemara or a sefer halakha, that your goal is simply to download what it says in the book into your mind, to register it as information the way you would download a file on the internet, that's not Talmud Torah. That's called simply copying files. Talmud Torah means that you are analyzing Torah. When Chazal used the word Talmud or Limud, they use that to refer to analysis. When they want to say copying, they say Lishnot or Lishanen, to repeat something, to learn it by repetition. That's Mishnah. But Talmud means analysis. It means thinking. It means putting into the source your own self as a mediator of context, so that you ask yourself important questions about what the text is saying, and you can therefore put yourself into the process. That's called Talmud Torah. And the centrality of Svara, the centrality of reasoning in the study of Jewish texts, is so great. The Gemara, in many places, when it wants to pose a question on a source from the period of the Mishnah, where a Tana, for instance, might have brought a verse to back up his position, or an Amora will bring a verse to back up his position, the Gemara will say, Kra lamali, why do I need a source? Svarahu, it's only logical. And you don't need a source for something that is logical. In other words, the prime method of learning is logic, not source bringing. Source bringing is when there is not a clear logic, then you need a source to back up your position. But if you have a compelling svara, you have a compelling logical argument for something, that is the most important piece of argumentation you can have. Now, if svara is so important, and if logic is so important, how does this play out in different kinds of sources? And I want to demonstrate to you in three or four different kinds of sources that we learn when we learn Torah, how thinking is so important. And I'd like to try to explain in the course of the lecture why it is that thinking about Torah sources has become more rare than it should be in our day. What has happened in the last 50 to 100 years that causes schools more and more to treat Torah as information rather than as teaching the willingness to think? Halakha, first of all, means thinking. When a person learns halakha, what exactly are they doing? And I'd like to present to you the words of Avram ben Arambam when he's talking about the Dina Devar Mitzra. Dina Devar Mitzra is a case, it's a complication that has to do with property law, the right of first refusal of an owner of contiguous property to buy a property that comes up for sale. And Avram ben Arambam is interested really in how one learns cases in halakha. And he says, Klalo shel davar, the general principle is, Omer ani, shedayan she'eino holech bipsakav, ela achar ma shekatzuv umufurash, hu chalash virafe. I say that any judge that in his piskei din only goes after that which is written and clarified in the sources, he is weak, and ineffectual. Ulefi ze yitpatel masha amru ein ledayan ela masha inavroot. And by doing this, only going by what is written and not by what his svara, what his thinking tells him, he will nullify what it says in the sources that a dayan's most important instrument is what his own eyes see. When a dayan, when a posek looks at a case, the most important thing he has is how he understands the circumstances, not what's written in the books. What's written in the books is for a purpose Avram ben Arambam will explain. He says, Eina davar kein, this is not the way you're supposed to look at things, to only look at the book. Ela hadvarim aktuvim hem ha'ikar. It's true that that which is written is the source, it's the main source. Vitzarich hadan din o hamorehu ra'ah lishkol otam lefi kol ma'aseh v'ma'aseh balafanav. And when you take the sources that are written, a judge or a posek, or a scholar is supposed to judge every case that comes before him on its own merits based on his understanding of the sources. And he's supposed to compare case to case and derive new principles based on what he has understood in the sources. And all of these cases that were written in the Talmud were not written there so that we will do exactly the way it's written in the book. It's not that a person should look in the Talmud and say, well, in this case, we see that the Amora paskin like this, and therefore, I must paskin the way the Amora said. Not at all. He says, Ela, kedei sheyisagel hachacham bishom'o otam harbe pi'amim, koach shel shikul da'at v'derech tova pehora alemaseh. But rather that by reading all of the cases over and over again that are in the Mishnah and the Talmud, a posek will enable himself to learn how to think, to apply shikul da'at, so that when a case comes before him, he will know how to apply the old criteria according to his analysis today. That means that it is not a direct equation that what is written in the book is therefore what is done. There's a third step in the middle. What is done and what is recorded in the book is the raw material. The process is inside the human being, and what is done is the process of combining those two things. So the human being, the living, breathing, thinking human being, is the critical element in the translation of precedental literature into action. And if that source was not enough, this source is even more powerful. The Magid Mishnah, commentary on the Rambam, also on the issue of Dina de Bar Mitzvah, on the right of first refusal of a neighbor to buy a property that comes up for sale, he says, Inyan din bar hametzar hu, shetoratenu hatmima, nitna bitikun midot ha'adam uvahan hagato ba'olam. That our Torah was given for the perfection of the characteristics of the person and the way he behaves in the world. Klalam be'omra kidoshim tiyu. And that's what the Torah meant when it said, be holy. Meaning, work on your characteristics, work on the way you behave in the world to become a more perfect human being. V'akavana, and the meaning of it is, kamo she'amru chazal, kadesh atzmach b'mutar lach. It's like Chazal said to us, sanctify yourself even in those things that are permitted to you. And now, listen to the words of the Magid Mishnah. V'lo min ha'ra'ui b'chol zeh litzavot pratim. It would not be appropriate, if based on what I've said, that the Torah would bring us all the details for all the cases that could ever be. Lefi she'mitzvot ha'Torah hein b'chol et u'b'chol zman u'b'chol inyan, because the mitzvot of the Torah are to be relevant in all times and all periods and in every matter. Ve'ayichrei chayav la'asot ken u'midot ha'adam v'hanhagato mitchalfot lefi hazman v'ayishim. But the characteristics of people and behavior in the world change according to the times. And if people and circumstances are always changing, that means that the application of the basic laws brought in the books must also change. Why? Because we have an equation. And the halachic thinking process is like this. You take precedental literature, which is fixed literature, it's written, it's a constant. You apply to that the circumstances of the case coming in front of you. And as the Magid Mishnah said, circumstances are a variable. You apply to that shikul da'at, that is your own reasoning ability, which is also a variable. Now, anyone who knows even the least about mathematics will know that when you multiply a constant by a variable, what do you get? You get a variable. You must get a variable. And that's why psak halacha must be variable. It's as simple as that. Now, when you talk about halakha changing, it's not that halakha is changing. The basic principles are remaining the same because the specific applications are changing. If you don't change the specific application, you're going to end up changing the values. And this is why thinking is a fundamental tool in the study of Torah. If a child walks away from school with the idea that when you have a problem in front of you, you open up a Mishnah Brura, and what it says there, that's what you do, the child has learned nothing about halakha. He's learned literature, but not halakha. Because halakha would mean, I have to see what the Mishnah Berurah wrote. I have to ask, how would that apply in the circumstances that are now applicable in my own day? What would the Mishnah Berurah say in my circumstances? Not what did he say in his circumstances. I'm sorry? And then he'd have to ask his Rav. And if he'd ask to make sure that his Rav, when he asks him, he understands his own circumstances. Because if the Rav doesn't understand his circumstances, he's passing it out of books, and we get back to what Avraham ben Rambam said. So in the area of halakha, in the area of the study of Jewish law and practice, thinking is a fundamental part of the curriculum. Otherwise, a child will not learn halakha at all. It will just learn precedence. But it's not only in halakha. It's even more so in Agadah. When we learn Midrashei Agadah or Agadot Chazal, which deal with non-halachic issues, they deal with meta-halachic issues, philosophy, ethics, morals, hashkafa, attitudes. The Rambam, in his introduction to Perek Chelek of Masechet Sanhedrin, warns us about being literal thinkers in this respect. And he says, "Benogea lidivrei chachamim zichronam livracha," when it comes to the words of our rabbis, meaning agadic words of our rabbis, "Nechleku b'nei adam l'shalosh kitot," people subdivide into three groups. The first group, "Vehi rov masharaiti," and that's most people as what I have seen, says the Rambam, "Hem ma'aminim utam al pshutam, ve'ein sovrim behem pirush nistar b'shum panim, ve'animnoot hen kulan etzlam mechuyavut ha'metziut." He says that most people take Midrashei Agadah literally. When it says that Rivka was 3 years old when she married Yitzchak, was Rivka chronologically 3 years old when she married Yitzchak? Is that how we picture one of the Avot Ha'uma, that he has relations with a three-year-old girl? Now, anyone who thinks that that Midrash is meant literally, he doesn't need a rabbi. He needs a psychologist. And Agadot Chazal, by their definition, are non-literal. So when a person applies literal thinking to non-literal texts, he creates dangerous conclusions. And the Rambam says, why does this happen? Om namo simkein, the reason why people do this, why do they think literally? Lefi shelo ivinu achochmot, because they don't know enough about science, about the way the world works. Vehem rechokim min atfunot, they're far away from deep understanding of reality. Ve'ein behem min ashlimut kedei she'itoru mi'aleihem, and because they're not full and perfect in themselves, they can't wake up on their own. Ve'hem lo matzu me'orer she'ye'orer otam, and they haven't found anyone who can wake them up from outside. Ve'sovrim shelo kivnu ha'chachamim zichronam livracha b'chol divreim ha'yesharim v'ha'metukanim elo ma she'evinu hein lefi da'atam v'shem ha'pshutam. And therefore they assume that Chazal only could have meant the things that they, on their low level, can understand. In other words, instead of bringing themselves up to a higher understanding of Chazal, they bring Chazal down to their own level of understanding and assume if Chazal said that Alexander Mokdon got up on an eagle and flew to the sky, then he must have done that. And if you ask them, well, how could that be possible? So they'll tell you, well, he must have had a big eagle. Or if you ask people, for instance, if you ask a person, when was the Torah given? And they'll say, at Har Sinai. And you'll say, was all of the five books of the Torah given at Har Sinai? And they'll say, well, of course, isn't that what we believe? Because their teachers told them Torah was given at Har Sinai. And then you'll ask them a question. Wait a minute. If Torah was given at Har Sinai, and Moshe at Har Sinai was told that he's going to hit the rock instead of speaking to it, and therefore he's going to be cursed and punished that he won't go into Eretz Yisrael, and then he, short time after that, he comes to that rock, and he still hits it? That's the way we understand Moshe's intelligence? Or he reads in what he's given at Sinai that Korach is going to rebel against and be swallowed up by the ground. And then it happens a little while later, and he just lets it happen, no problem. I know what's going to happen to you, buddy. And he doesn't do anything? That's how we understand Moshe Rabbeinu? And the fact is that not one Tana or one Amora ever believed that the full five books of the Torah were given at Sinai. They believed that the Torah was given at Sinai, everything that happened up to Sinai, and from Sinai until the entrance into Eretz Yisrael was a machloket, whether it was given piece by piece or altogether in Arvot Moav. Because our rabbis were not simple-minded people. Our rabbis were geniuses. They would never allow themselves to think something that was ridiculous. And I remember when we studied with Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he was once asked a question whether something is mutter or aser. And he said, whether it's mutter or aser, I can't tell you, but I can tell you that it's foolish, and anything foolish is aser. So the question is, as educators and as rabbis, how do we function with people in order to bring them to be willing to think about what they're doing? And in Agadah, therefore, what we want to do is teach children how to think with symbolism, that when it says a tree, you know the famous Agadat Chazal about Tanurosh al-Achnai, where Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua have this argument about the oven, and Rabbi Eliezer wants to prove his case from miracles that happen around, such as that the tree flies into the air and the water runs up backwards and the walls of the Beit Midrash are going to leap. These things are not physical events. The tree represents something. The water represents something. Kotlei Beit HaMidrash, the walls of the Beit Midrash represent something. It's national poetry. And Chazal cloaked it in these kinds of terms in order that we would be able to remember it as a story, but never only on that level. So we have to teach children how to think in symbols, how to think in metaphor, and how to think in typologies. Numbers are not what... 40 doesn't mean 40, it means a concept. The way we say about Sarah, that the Torah says she was Bat Mea, Bat Esrim, Bat Sheva, that she died at 127 years old, that she was at 100, she was beautiful as she was when she was 20, and when she was 20, she was as innocent as she was when she was 7. That the numbers are typological. Now the problem is here that the thinking in halakha is different than the thinking in Agadah. Because Agadah, you're thinking symbolically. If you think symbolically in halakha, you think when the Rav says Asur, he's only talking symbolically, then you're in trouble. So you have a child has to be taught that in every area of Jewish studies, there are patterns and rules of thinking that are to be applied in that area, but not in other areas. What we're doing, therefore, is building, what we should be doing, is building inside of children's minds and adults' minds as well, toolboxes of sets of tools that are to be applied to different kinds of rabbinic literature. And a child has to know how to strategize, how to say, what kind of material do I have in front of me? Is this an agadah? Is this a halakha? What tools do I have to use in order to understand this piece of literature correctly and then think that way? And that is what we do really in our own native languages. In English, for instance, if I put before you a poem and I put before you a historical narrative, you would apply different skill sets to those things. If I told you a story about a duck that talked to a horse and you interpret it literally as you would a historical narrative, then you're going to find yourself before too long in a beautiful white jacket because you'll be considered psychotic. So why is it that in learning rabbinic literature do we allow children to grow into adults where their thinking is still on a very, very low and primitive level, where they don't know how to distinguish between one kind of literature and the other? But it's not only true in halakha and in Agadah. It's also true in Mishnah. Let's take a look at this Mishnah. Some of you learned it with me in the past. When you look at Mishnah, you think you're seeing a text. It's a printed text. But you don't realize when you look at it that the Mishnah is not a text at all. It's a collection of oral traditions that have been passed down in a very specific way. And it's a three-dimensional model. Because in this Mishnah, which tells us that on the day of Rosh Hashanah, which falls out on Shabbat, in the Mikdash, they allowed the shofar to be blown, but not in the rest of the country. That, of course, that law is from what period of time? From the period of the Beit Mikdash, is it not? It reflects the law that was prevalent at the time of the Mikdash. And then the Mishnah tells us, Misha Harav Beit Mikdash, Kin Rabban Yochanan Ben Zakai Shutokin, Bechol Makom Sheish Bo Beitin, that when the Mikdash was destroyed and they went to Yavne, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a decree that they would blow the shofar not only in the Mikdash, but anywhere where there is a Beit Din. What period is this from? It's from Yavne, is it not? The period after the destruction of the Beit Mikdash. That's clear, it says it itself. But what do you do with the next line? Amar Rabbi Elazar, Lo Hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Ela B'Yavne Bilvad. That the decree of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was only in Yavne. Amrulo and the others said to him, no, it doesn't matter Yavne or any place else where there is a Beit Din. When is that from? So the only way you can know is to know what? What do you need to know? Who is Rabbi Elazar? So when children or adults learn that Rabbi Elazar is Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, who lived three generations after Yochanan ben Zakkai in Usha, after the destruction of Beitar, and the Sanhedrin went to the north, then what he sees here in front of him is a text, which is not a text at all. It's three texts, which like slides have been put one on top of the other, that represent three different slices of Jewish history in which the circumstances have changed. And the rabbis in each case had to make a determination how to apply the halakha based on the prevailing circumstances. So really, this is not a text. It's a three-dimensional model that's supposed to teach you how the rabbis thought in each generation as they went along. Now, in order to teach this kind of three-dimensional thinking to anyone, to adults or to a child, there, we have to teach, of course, basic data. We have to teach who were the Chachamim, what happened at the different periods of time, and we have to learn to teach Mishnah in a way that where children can pick this up, preferably orally, and not as a written text. So in Halakha, and in Agadah, and in Mishnah, thinking becomes a critical process of text evaluation. Otherwise, the text becomes meaningless. But it's not only there. It's not only in Mishnah thinking where you have laws and layers. You have to take into account time, place, and circumstances, the dynamic process of the halakha, the rabbinic authority in every generation, and how reality plays a role in psak. This is a critical point, Rabotai. People think, and it's not a matter of Haredi or modern Orthodox, it's a matter of simple thinkers versus complex thinkers. Some people have the tendency to think that halakha is an algebraic system that is operating somehow in the air, unconnected to the ground, to what's happening on the ground. This, of course, is false. Halakha, reality is not the enemy of halakha. Reality is a function within halakha. This is also true in the learning of Talmud. And because our time is limited, I just want to show you one example of what we're talking about. Here is the first sugya of Perek Elu Mitziot in Masechet Bava Mitziah, which has been laid out in a slightly new way. It's exactly the same text, but what we've done is we've laid the text out in such a way that the blue letters, as you see here or here, are the words of the Tanaim. Red are the words of the Amoraim, who lived after the Tanaim from the year 200 to about the year 500. And the black is commentary on the words of the Tanaim and Amoraim, which is likely either to be from either the very end of the period of the Amoraim or from the Savoraim, from 500 to about 650. Now, these three layers in the text think differently. They think differently because the Tanaim and Amoraim are thinking halachically, whereas this part, the black part, which they either call, you can either call it the Gemara or the Talmudah or the Stamma de Talmudah or the Shakla Vitaria, those pieces are thinking as conceptual abstractions. It's conceptualization. It's a higher order thinking than the concrete thinking that we find by the Tanaim and Amoraim. Now, if a child learns the entire text as one continuum, as it is presented in Vilna, in the Vilna edition, then the child is assuming that because it's presented as one continuum, all of the thinking is the same in the text. Nothing could be further from the truth. And all of the nuances of the text, all of the speculative analysis that takes place in the Stamma de Talmudah on the words of the Tananima is completely lost on this individual because he thinks it's all written by the same person at the same time. So what we have seen really from examining all of these examples in Halakha, in Agadah, in Mishnah, and in Talmud is that if there is not a purposeful and designed and directed thinking process, we will find ourselves in a position of just teaching downloads and not teaching real Torah. And I'd like to ask you how it happens then that in so many, and we do see it in so many schools. We see it a lot in Israel, and we see it a lot here in North America. It's not that, as though they once said that all the losers went to Israel. You know, someone, who was it that said that? All the losers went to Israel in the, was that the president of the OU by any chance?
It was Shalia.
Yeah. although today we heard that it was a brain drain, that it was the brains that went to Israel. That's already, we're moving in the right direction. In any event, you see it in America and you see it in Israel as well. That is that many times schools teach just data. You'll ask a child, as soon as you ask a child why or what do you think about what you've learned, all of a sudden you get this blank stare like my three-year-old grandson when I asked him how could it be that his uncle is marrying his aunt. You know, tilt, 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 and just walk away. Well, I want to explain to you how this happened based on the writings of a clinical psychologist named Gordon Neufeld. I don't know if any of you have read, he's a Canadian actually. He lives in Vancouver. And he is quite a well-known clinical psychologist. He wrote a book called Hang On to Your Kids, which is a book about parenting theory. But the model that he builds in about parenting theory in the book is a perfect explanation for how we have come to the point in Jewish life where teachers think that their role is to teach data and not thinking. Because it is my contention, and I don't have time today to prove it, but I'm convinced that this is so from my research, that until approximately 100 years ago, what I told you today so far was obvious to any Talmid Chacham or Posek that lived on the face of the earth. It was part of the Masorah. It was part of the tradition about the way people learned and thought in the scholarly community. It would, as I remember when I first started working on these things and I went to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu in Israel, one of the great poskim we have today, and I presented these things to him. He said to me, Pshita, so this is all obvious. What is your chidush? Everyone learns this way. I said to him, Rebbe, people are not learning this way. He said, what do you mean? How are they learning? So I said, they're learning everything as if it's all one continuum. He said, but that's ridiculous. How do they understand the text like that? It was obvious to him. And when I grew up in Iraq, said, all of us learned this way. And the more chachamim and poskim I interviewed, I found that really all of the great scholars always learned this way. It was obvious to them. So how did it come to this break in the Masorah that people in the last two or maybe three generations have not been teaching thinking schools, but have only been teaching data? I want to read you a few words of Gordon Neufeld about parenting, and you'll see what I mean. He says as follows, culture, until recently, was always handed down vertically from generation to generation. For millennia, wrote Joseph Campbell, the youth have been educated and the aged rendered wise through the study, experience, and understanding of traditional cultural forms. Adults played a critical role in the transmission of culture, taking what they received from their own parents and passing it down to their children. That is, that the structure of society was that the authority in the home was the parent, and the authority in the community was the rabbi and the wise. And this vertical construction of society meant that children, as they grew up in this kind of what we would call an attachment community, attached themselves to their parents and to their teachers and to their rabbis, seeing them as the guides of their life, and they would absorb the tradition from them and carry it on to the next generation. And this is the way things were until, however, the culture our children are being introduced to is much more likely to be the culture of their peers. Children are generating their own culture, very distinct from that of their parents and in some ways also very alien. Instead of culture being passed down vertically, it is being transmitted horizontally within the younger generation. That is, peers in the lives of our children, peers have become more important than parents. When that happens, the break in the attachment between the previous generation and the younger generation causes a break in the passage of the Masorah, and a new and foreign, superficial and false culture is created among a younger generation that has no guidance from the past and is passed on horizontally, one from the other. And parents in such a society, and that is the society in North America today, parents and teachers feel a need, in order to be accepted, to make themselves part of the culture of the children, rather than the children, in order to be accepted, having to make themselves part of the culture of their parents and teachers. The world is upside down. Olam hafuch ani ro'eh. And because this has happened in general culture, it's happening in Jewish culture too. Neufeld goes on to say, according to a large international study headed by the British child psychologist Sir Michael Rutter and a criminologist David Smith, a children's culture first emerged after the Second World War and is one of the most dramatic and ominous social phenomena of the 20th century. Accompanying the rise in a children's culture, distinct and separate from the mainstream culture, were increases in youth crime, violence, bullying, and delinquency. This has nothing to do with the learning of Talmud, but the model is what interests me. What he is saying is that when the vertical Masorah is broken, children create as best they can a culture, and that becomes the dominant culture of the society. It is rootless. It is what a an Israeli commentator called Gidulei Maim, people that grew up in water instead of in the ground. And this is what is happening in the Torah world. Because of the destruction in European Jewry of large numbers of great Talmidei Chachamim, we have in Jewish culture today something that has never happened before, where a younger generation is attempting to recreate what appears to itself to be what was, just out of the physical remnants of what was. Books, stories, but the actual Masorah of how one is to think and how one is to learn has been broken. And once the generation horizontally tries to recreate in its own image what was, it then becomes dogmatic in its own approach, where if they had been vertically transmitted, the dogma would have been avoided. And we end up with an unusually paradoxic situation that children end up being much more machmir in their way of thinking, simplistic, dogmatic, than their parents and their grandparents were. And I believe that this is what has happened to Torah culture. The Masorah has been broken, and in order for us to solve the difficulties that we have in education today, we have to go back. It might sound strange to you. I spent 18 years in academia, and I'm coming to tell you that we have to go back to the old way. That's exactly what I am saying. Because Chazal and the Rishonim and the Gedolei Achronim knew more about education than do all of the Western educationalists we have today together. And we have to look for our guidance by recreating, not recreating what was in our image, but recreating ourselves in their image. This is what he says as follows. How does thinking conquer dogma? Children cannot be oriented to both adults and other children simultaneously. One cannot follow two sets of conflicting directions at the same time. The child's brain must automatically choose between parental values and peer values, parental guidance and peer guidance, parental culture and peer culture, whenever the two would appear to be in conflict. Would any of you like to guess which one they'll choose? This is the real meaning of Khurban, the real meaning of the destruction and the exile. What is the repair? And I'd like to finish in the next 2 to 3 minutes so there could be questions. The way that a community, let's say the community of Toronto, wants to recreate the Masorah and get children thinking critically again and not just absorbing downloaded information through schools, there has to be systemic thinking. The community as a whole, that includes rabbis, synagogues, schools, youth groups, parents, have to create what I would call an attachment community. An attachment community, that is, a community that will attempt to purvey, to recreate the vertical construction of the Masorah and purvey that to the children in an organized and consistent manner. Second of all, that attachment community must define criteria for attachment, that is, define the criteria that are expected of youth growing up within that community in order to be deemed adult members of that community. Define criteria for attachment and include thinking skills in all of these different areas as a prime target. That is, if we have to communicate to our children that it is simply inadequate to learn a text without thinking about it. It's just, we don't do that here. It's like, what do you say when your children come home and say to you, but my friend's parents allow him to do that? What's the answer? I can only tell you what my parents told me. My parents used to say, we don't do that in our home. We don't do that in our home. That, in other words, there has to be an attachment community that children have to understand that to be accepted as members of the community, they must attach themselves to those who are the bearers of the tradition. And assert and encourage attachment of the young to the leaders of the community and do not tolerate dogma. Simply do not tolerate dogma. If a child comes home with a simplistic way of thinking about something, I mean, what is Shabbat for? It's not for chicken soup. Shabbat is sit around the table so you have a chance to question your children and grandchildren about what they have learned and educate them appropriately, according to the way that they should be educated. I remember when my children were in kindergarten and in first grade, when they knew they sat down to the Friday night table, they knew they were in for a session. Because they needed to report to me what they have learned, and we would talk about, how do you think about that? What do you think about that? What's the right way to understand that? And you know something? When they bring home the sheets of the Agadot Chazal and Parshat Shavua, about all the wild and woolly things that the Agadah says about the Parsha, if a parent just says, oh, isn't that nice, and the child goes on to adulthood thinking that the Agadot are meant to be taken literally, the parent is an accomplice in the breaking of the Masorah. The parent has to become part of the attachment community and insist that his children learn how to think. With courage, without fear, as Dr. Schick said before, we have to train our children to be courageous, critical thinkers within the Masorah, because that's what the Masorah is. And only parents and teachers and rabbis who will band together to create a community like that, an attachment community, will raise children they can be proud of. Well, I think I've probably said enough, and I'd be happy to take questions at this time. I think this, isn't there a mic here that can be, I think this mic is meant to be, yeah. We'll turn it on. Let's turn it on.
You're asking me to do technical things that I'm not really well trained to do.
Turn it on dogmatic.
I think it's down here, if I'm not mistaken.
It's lit up, so how's that? Better? I pushed all the buttons. I know how to push. Okay, well, I think we'll have to proceed as best we can. And,
first question. Yeah.
Married, had kids, and all of a sudden realized that there were problems in the Gemara with modern science. You know,
what do you mean problems of modern science? What does that mean?
What the Gemara stated as fact did not jive with some of the scientific knowledge, like the earth and the agamim in Psachim, where the waters are heated below and all that. And interestingly enough, he went to Professor Dr. Yeshaya Leibovitz, and he said to him, you know, you have to divide up between the values of the Gemara and the real lessons of the Gemara and science, which are two different areas, and you have to resolve the difference, but, you know, you have to not resolve the difference, you have to live with the fact that the Gemara is not a book of science, etc., etc. Well, he did not accept that, and so much so that he's putting out pamphlets called Torat Emet, which he distributes in yeshivot, and being the chutzpahdik that he became, he put down Shmirat Hadaf, you know, watch, don't. And in there he has all kinds of problems with, I would say, your approach. And therefore, what I'm asking you is this a problem? This could be a problem with people that say, you know, I believed it all. But now you're telling me not to believe it, and what's going to be? And I can think about some societies where, if you say about the eagle, particularly, I don't want to mention where, they would say, exactly, no problem.
The definitions are mistaken, because for such an individual that you describe is exactly what I referred to before, a gidul mayim, someone that's grown up in water and not grounded. Because if, for instance, if one would read the writings, for instance, in Israel, one of the I would say the right-wing representative of the Mizrahi movement in Israel is a Rosh Hashiva by the name of Rav Tzvi Tau, who is the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivat Har Amor. He's originally from Holland. He came on Aliyah, studied with Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and now is a Rosh Hashiva. He wrote a beautiful article approximately 2 or 3 years ago where he dealt with the issue of Torah and science. And he is unabashed. He is brave. He isn't the least bit concerned about what anyone has to say about him. And he comes out and he says very clearly, the science of Chazal is based on the knowledge of signs that existed in their day and is not necessarily correct according to what we know today. What is so difficult about this? Do we expect Chazal to be Nevi'im? They are not Nevi'im. They're Chachamim. Now, on a psychological level, when a person says either everything in Divrei Chazal is true, like Psak Halacha, or it's all false, then what he's saying about himself is that there's a fault in his own personality. He's unable to distinguish layers, events, circumstances. He's unable to see that the world is an evolving organism. So that's a problem in his own personality. It has nothing to do with the Masorah. Anyone with a Masorah from teachers who understood how to learn would never have a problem with this kind of thing.
I think I saw a question over here and then another one over there.
What you were saying about the learning of Agadah and the idea that we shouldn't be taking certain symbolic things literally made a lot of sense to me, but I was just wondering how you approach explaining stories in Navi and Chumash, which also, like, let's say a duck speaking to a horse in Agadah sounds crazy, but a donkey speaking in Chumash, I think a lot of people have a tendency to take more literally, and for that matter, Kriyat Yamsuf and stories in Breishit and your approach to that are, you know, a little hard, I think, for us to see as maybe having actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I would refer you to the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim, Perek Mem Gimel, Chelik Shlishi, I think, where the Rambam discusses exactly your question. And the Rambam has his own theory there about how to understand things in the Torah and the Nevi'im that are miraculous. He splits them into different categories, things that happen to an individual as opposed to things that happen to the klal. And he says things that happen to the individual were visions, and things that happen to the klal were real. You can read it there for yourself. But Chazal dealt with these issues. The Rishonim dealt with these issues. All of the Rishonim, without an exception, no Rishon ever said that one should take Midrashei Agadah or Agadot Chazal literally. No Rishon ever said that. The Rashba said in one place that you may take an Agadah literally as long as it does not contradict the laws of nature. You're asking me my personal approach, or you're asking me the approach of... There are different approaches. My personal approach is very much in accordance with what the Rambam writes there, personally. But there might be other approaches. But what I'm saying is that the approaches have to all be based on a consistent way of thinking about learning. And the thinking process was what has to be handed down to children, not only the data.
I think we have time for one more quick question.
You said that we have been detached since approximately the Second World War. If we are detached, how do we reattach?
Well, the way that when we began our research about 5 years ago and we came to the realization that such a high percentage of children graduating from yeshivot tichoniot in Israel and also in America don't know how to learn, even though they've been spending a dozen hours a week for 6 years learning Gemara. They know a lot of material, but they don't know how to learn. We felt that the reason for that, after our research, was not because the children were unable to learn, although there were Talmidei Chachamim we spoke to that felt that Gemara should only be learned by the top 10 percentile. We disagree with that. And we felt the problem is not with the teachers. We found the teachers to be generally very committed and very dedicated. The problem was that that we have lost in modern teaching a scope and sequence of skills for Torah Shebal Peh and for Torah Shebal Bichtav as well. That is, you look at the curricula, even of Misrad HaChinuch in Israel, of the religious education ministry in Israel, or of all of the agencies, including Torah Mesorah and all the other teaching agencies in North America, there is virtually no definition of skills. There is definition only of content. And therefore, children are not learning how to learn. So what we did was, I sat down with about 30 other rebbeim in yeshivot, and we scanned Rishonic literature and Achronic literature in order to pull up from that literature all the sources we could find about method and about thinking. We found in the space of 3 months over 500 sources. And we began to piece them onto the table like a jigsaw puzzle in order to try to recreate the scope and sequence of skills that the Rishonim used for the study of sources. And we discovered, to our amazement, number one, that the Rishonim from all countries used the basic same skill set for the understanding of Torah Shebo Peh, number one. And number two, that the way we learn today in the yeshivas is not the way the Rishonim learned, and is not the way the great Gedolim of the period of the Acharonim learned either. And if you would like, those of you that read Hebrew well and you'd like to see this, you can read the Hesped that was said by Rav Kook about the Netziv, who was his Rebbe. Rav Kook was the Talmid Mufak of the Netziv of Voloshin, and the Netziv said it was would have been worthwhile opening the yeshiva in Voloshin just for Rav Kook. And Rav Kook writes, when he describes how the Netziv taught them and how he wanted people to learn, he describes a method how the Netziv wanted people to learn that he had on Masorah from his Rebbeim. And that's what we have tried to recreate.
I think we have to continue the conversation at our next Friday night dinner. I hope we're all planning our study sessions. In the meantime, let's thank Rabbi Dr. Haman for a wonderful session.